Chaver Shalom Aleichem. It's Binyamin Hammer at the National Council of Young Israel, and we are honored to have with us Rabbi Mordechai Willig, who will now answer to help us understand the Shabbos for this past week. We are up to conference call number 4, and we look forward to it. Thank you, Rabbi Willig.
Thank you, Binyamin. Question number 1. Teaching Hilchos Nida to Balei Tshuva. How proactive must the Rav be in bringing up these issues? In particular, if a Rav is being Masada Kedushin, to what extent must he ensure that the couple has learned Hilchos Nida? The answer is as follows. He was discussing an observant couple, including a Baal Tshuva couple. The Rav should see to it that the couple learn the Halachos of Nida appropriately. How they learn it, there are many different ways. With classes, with one-on-one, but it is the Rav's responsibility to see to it by simply asking the couple when he meets with them, as he should, well before the marriage, before the wedding, that they should be appropriately taught. Now, if we're dealing with someone who is not yet a Baal Tshuva, someone who is not observant, that's a whole different story. There's even a dispute whether the rabbi is allowed to be Masada Kedushin. In such a case, we generally assume that it's permissible on the grounds that they're violating the laws of Nida in any event. And let's at least remove the additional prohibition of their being together without the benefit of marriage. Only one thing. You have to be careful to see to it that somebody, you or someone you know from their family, has an ongoing relationship with them, or at least one of them, in the eventuality that the marriage breaks up, which unfortunately happens many times in America today, to make sure that they will, in fact, have a proper Jewish divorce if they do so. Otherwise, I recommend that one not be Masada Kedushin, even without this neither issue, because the fear is, yes, you are eliminating a prohibition right now, but chas v'shalom, it could lead to a much worse prohibition of adultery with much worse consequences on a personal level of mamzerus. And therefore, I would say that if the couple is not yet observant, then you shouldn't even do it. You shouldn't do the wedding unless you have some kind of ongoing connection yourself or with the chosn and kalo and or a family member, such as a parent who's a member of your shul, who will inform you if it breaks up, they should be able to see that a proper get is given. In any event, even if a non-observant couple is what you're dealing with, it's still very much worthwhile to suggest that the woman go to the mikveh before the marriage. You're an Orthodox rabbi, they're coming to you to do the performance of the wedding. Part of the wedding ceremony is the immersion of the bride, the ritual immersion before the actual wedding. And you know, even though they've been together for 4 in most cases and they're not careful about neither and other things, you never know. Once in a while there are cases where a woman goes to the mikveh even once and it makes a big impact upon her. It can make her more spiritual. And even if she's going now before the wedding and it's not really a proper tevila, maybe she didn't do proper vedikas, there weren't proper shiva nikiyim, no matter. You should still encourage it, because in this way, there are many cases in which, as a result of that one-time event, if she likes it, and people are brought to Yiddishkeit from many different ways, and this is one of them, maybe you'll have a tremendous impact down the road. This is question 1. Question 2. The last call again. We spoke about a man going to a water park and gym. What if any issues apply to a woman? Presuming that she dressed in a tzniut fashion, would it be permitted for a woman to go to a mixed beach, water park, gym, etc.? This has to be analyzed from 2 different perspectives. For looks in the Chumash of Moshe Feinstein, Igris Moshe, Evan Ezer, Chelek Aleph Simon Nun Vav, there was a very clear distinction between 2 separate prohibitions. One is a prohibition which is called in the Gemara, Vinishmarta mikol dovara. A person shouldn't involve himself in certain activities, see certain things, because if he as a man, it may lead to what Gemara there calls tumah balayla, something we'll come to discuss a little bit later. And there's a prohibition that's obviously limited to males. There's an additional prohibition of lo sasu achrei einechem, which Gemara says at the end of the first paragraph of Brachas, is referring to znus. It's certain types of scenes or sights can lead to chas v'shalom, very serious prohibitions. Rav Moshe writes in that Shuvah that therefore, whenever we're discussing matters of this nature, one has to distinguish between a case in which there is a possibility that it could lead to immoral behavior. Then, of course, we are gender blind, and the prohibition applies equally to women as well as to men, as opposed to situations where that's not a fear. It's just the visual stuff itself to lead the man to this aveira from the Shemata and be called Avera, Tuba Balayla. But there's no chashashness at all for whatever the circumstances happen to be. Then it would be prohibited for a man, but the same activity would be permissible for a woman. This, of course, is relevant to, I guess, certain movies and other things that exist these days. Now, when it comes to this particular case in front of us, one has to be careful to know what the ambiance is in these particular places to know. Are we fearful of immorality coming as a result of these activities, in which case a woman should certainly stay far, far away? Or no, there's no such possibility whatsoever. Just a matter of what's seen visually, which again we spoke about last time, then the prohibition would be on a man, not on a woman. The truth is, it's very difficult to ascertain in advance whether there is a, we'll call it a spiritual danger, which leads to immorality down the road in these particular situations. If one is convinced there's no problem whatsoever, then it'll be permissible for a woman. If you're in doubt, I would say that's fake or lechumra. A woman should not go to these places. That's question number two. Question number three is a very difficult question. Is it permitted to pray at, eat at, be associated with a Chabad house if one suspects the Shaliach believes the Rebbe will have a second coming? As is known, a small percentage believes the Rebbe to be a manifestation of God, Elohists. Now, the word or Meshechist is not in the proper place. Just for clarification purposes, a Meshechist believes the Rebbe is Mashiach. Elohist means he believes the Rebbe is God. Is this miut, I assume he means of Elohists, enough to place suspicion of idolatry on the Rav? A very, very difficult and painful question to address. Let's begin by a statement of fact that Chabad houses throughout the world are doing fantastic work in terms of Kiruv, in terms of taking Jewish souls that have nothing to do whatsoever with Torah, with mitzvahs, with anything, with Judaism, with being Jewish, and bringing them closer to Avinu Shebashamayim, closer to Hashem, closer to Torah, closer to mitzvahs. And you know, sometimes they succeed all the way, some of the way. Sometimes they're successful preventing intermarriages. Sometimes people are going to keep kosher or Shabbos, or Taras HaMishpacha. Whatever it is, they're tremendous work throughout the world, literally. And we should not belittle the fact. There's tremendous chesed work throughout the world. People are stuck in who knows where. And there's no kosher food, there's no one to talk to, no one to help. And the wonderful emissaries, shluchim, of the Chabad movement have been tremendously helpful, both in the spiritual sense, as well as in the, we'll call the gemilas chesed sense. That has to be said as a statement of fact, which I think is absolutely undeniable. That being said, the issue that the shliach believes that the Rebbe will have a second coming is a very thorny issue. What are the percentages? Very difficult to know, because many, many of these shluchim, the emissaries of Chabad, are very, very silent on this matter. It's rare, it must be said also, it's rare to find a Chabad shliach, anyone connected with Chabad, who will tell you explicitly that I believe the Rebbe is not the Mashiach, that the Mashiach will come, a person will come who is alive just before he is appearing as the Mashiach, which is a simple read of the Rambam. But you will rarely find a Chabad shliach or member, if you want to use that term in a broad sense, who will say so. There are, for sure, but I believe it's a small percentage. This is not to say what the true beliefs are of those who call the silent majority. Clearly the majority is silent on this issue, and it's hard to know with precision. I once spoke about this topic. It's always a painful topic, and I said what I thought was true, and may still really be true, that a large majority of the silent majority in fact believe that the Rebbe is Mashiach. This is not something which I say on my own, although I've seen some anecdotal evidence, but it's certainly something which is said by open Mashiachists, those who believe that the Rebbe is Mashiach, and when they get attacked, it's, why are you so, are you an extreme? They say, what do you mean I'm an extreme? It's an open secret. Everyone in the world knows that the entire Chabad Hasidus believes the Rebbe is the Mashiach, but for various reasons, they're not going to tell you about it. And they say, in proof, because they're not going to tell you that's not so. They're not going to say they believe the Rebbe is not Mashiach. That is a fact. Nonetheless, after I made that statement, I was subject to criticism. How do you know? Maybe it's not true. So, okay, I will say maybe it's not true. So we don't have to get into an argument of whether there's a large majority of the silent Chabad Shluchim who believe that the Rebbe is Mashiach, or that whether there is no such large majority, or maybe no majority at all. It's impossible to have a precise statistics because of the wall of silence which is imposed, self-imposed, I guess, by most of these Shluchim. So therefore, let's not get into this discussion, because it only can produce upset and anger, and that's certainly not what I want to do. So let us just move on. What about our case, the case at hand? So the person, the questioner, suspects the shaliach believes the Rebbe will have a second coming. If it's only a suspicion, that means there were no outward manifestation of this belief in the synagogue services. I mean, for example, the Yechi statement, which many Chabad shuls say at certain points of the davening, are not said. Because if it is said, then there's nothing to talk about suspicion. Then it's clear. It seems to me that given that circumstance, it's permissible for an individual to pray at such a Chabad house, again, where there are no trappings, no chants, no pictures, no. There's no way to know by walking in that the Chabad emissary, and presumably he was controlled the thinking of the people, and generally believe that the Rebbe is the Mashiach. So even though you think you have a suspicion that the Rebbe, that he, in fact, the shliach believes the Rebbe will have a second coming, but if he keeps that belief to himself, and you don't know about it, and you find yourself at a place where the only shul is a Chabad house, in my opinion, although others will certainly disagree with me, in my opinion, it's permissible to pray at such a Chabad house, because that, you don't know. let's say the shliach does believe that the Rebbe is a Mashiach, so he believes it. It doesn't make the shul, the Chabad house, a place where it's prohibited to pray. And I feel, therefore, that if that's the only shul around, a Chabad house, and that's true in many, many locations throughout the world, in such a circumstance, if you check it out in advance and see there's no trappings, no chance of Yechi, then I believe it's permissible to daven there. The second slash is to eat there. I believe it's permissible to eat there as well. And if you'll say, but how can you eat there? Maybe the Reb, the Shaliach, is what we call a Mashiachist, who believes the Reb is Mashiach. Even if he does, the same as I said, it's permissible to pray there. We wouldn't call it a Makom Avodah Zarah or anything of that type. So too, you're allowed to eat the food that is being served. And I believe, and I'm told that great Rabbonim, who have nothing to do with the Chabad movement, have concurred, have said the same thing, that if such an individual believes the Rebbe is Mashiach, even though it seems to go against the Rambam, is not an out-and-out denial of the 12th principle of faith, which we say in our Animamins, the Bias of Imam Bias of Mashiach, the fact that they are waiting for a Mashiach to return from the dead and to come back as the Mashiach, even though if you look in Hilchos Melachim, it sounds that the Rambam thinks that's an impossibility, as much as ink has been spilled about this. I'm not going to go into that right now. But even granting that it's against the Rambam and Hilchos Melachim, it does not automatically make an individual a denier of one of the 13 principles of the faith, which could have tremendous implications. And therefore, if he slaughters an animal, it's kosher. If he touches the wine, it's kosher. I believe that that is true. Of course, in most situations, with respect to the meat, he's not slaughtering the meat. He's buying it from somewhere else. You will very often find an OU on a slaughterhouse, which is manned by Shluchim of Chabad. I understand that they're relying on the assumption that even if the Shochet believes that the Rebbe is Mashiach, that the meat is kosher. I believe that's been attributed even to Rav Elyashiv, Zichron Livracha. And therefore, I believe that to answer the first two questions, may you pray at or eat at such a Chabad house, I think that it is permissible. Now, the third one is the most difficult, also hard to translate. Be associated with. Associated has many, many meanings. Normally, if a person associates himself with a particular institution, he does his due diligence to find out, you know, as much as he can, that everything is exactly the way he wants it, and otherwise he stays away. So for an individual to be associated with, I guess that means that that's your shul. Not that you're there because you're passing through, you're on vacation or whatever, in business. But that's your shul. That's where you affiliate. So there, I believe, a person, if he wants to affiliate with Chabad, should, again, assuming for the moment that the person who's asking the question, that's the whole tone of the question, does not believe that the Rebbe is going to have a second coming, which I think is always been the traditional view in throughout our history, that we assume, as I said before, as the Rambam seems to say clearly in Hilchos Melachim, that the Mashiach will not rise from the dead, but rather will be a live person who will appear as our Mashiach. Then I don't think one should be associated with, affiliated with, a full-time mispalel in a Chabad house, unless he's able to ascertain that the suspicion that he has is absolutely ungrounded, such as the Shaliach tells him, no, I believe the Rebbe is not the Mashiach. The Mashiach will be a live person. Then I believe, assuming that he presumes the Shaliach telling him the truth, then I see no problem with affiliating there, as long as it's a situation which is, you know, what he, as long as he's, what he sees is in, fits in with what the shaliach is telling him. Yes, the, in the broader movement, there are unfortunate manifestations, which some of which we'll discuss momentarily, but this particular institution that he's part of is headed by a shaliach, and the shaliach tells him, I believe that the Rebbe, since he passed away, I believe that the Rebbe is not going to be the Mashiach, it's going to be someone else, and that's the tone of the of the prayer service. I believe that it's permissible to even do the third, to associate with such a Chabad house. Now, the second part of the question is even more painful. It talks about idolatry. There are unfortunate manifestations thereof. I'm not going to read them to you now on the phone. It's very painful. It's out there. There are many places you can find them. I'm not giving away any secrets. There certainly is a some group out there. And the question is the miut enough? So we have halachas over here when it comes to miut. There's a concept called the miut ha-matsui and the miut she'ena matsui. It's a question of whether it's a prevalent minority or a very rare minority. There's a whole discussion in the Poskim where they draw the line between the two. So the Mishkanos Yaakov says 10%. If they're more than 10%, it's a miut ha-matsui. Less than 10%, it's ena matsui. If it's matsui, you have to worry about it. If it's ena matsui, you need not. So what is the percentage? It seems to me, and that was the assumption of my first answer, that among what I call the silent majority, who are saying nothing about the Rebbe as being even the Mashiach, that the miut that believes that the Rebbe is God, things of this nature, is a miut she'eno matsui. That's why I said before, there's no problem with the wine, and there's no problem with the shechita of such an individual, because if he doesn't declare the Rebbe to be the Mashiach, so the chance that he believes that he's not only the Mashiach, but he's even God, this is very small, in my opinion, less than 10%. The serious halacha question is, within the number of shluche Chabad, and again, this presumably can be determined, because it's not, there's no silent wall about this, what percentage of the total Chabad shluchim say explicitly that the Rebbe is the Mashiach, and they have the Yechi, and they have the pictures, and the whole nine yards, what percentage of the shluchim actually believe in that, I do not know, and I don't feel it's necessary for me to even give a guess, because that's a matter of fact in each and every case, each and every house, individually. So it's irrelevant whether that person is part of a 1% or a 20%. It's an immaterial statistic, because we're dealing with a particular individual. So the question then becomes, which is the material statistic, within that group, as large and as small as it may be, both in absolute numbers and percentages, within that group, what percentage of those individuals who declare they are to be the Mashiach believe in the idolatrous strand within that group? I'm convinced that it's a minority, that even within those who pronounce the Rebbe as the Mashiach and they're sure he's going to come back and redeem us, but I'm convinced that the minority, it's only a minority of those who say that, that attribute any deity to the Rebbe. But the question is, what is the nature of that minority? Is that minority a miut ha-matsui or miut ha-einu matsui? I would like to think it's a miut ha-einu matsui. It's less than 10% of the avowed mashichistim or elokistim, but I do not have the ability to ascertain that. If someone can ascertain that for me, that's less than 10%, then there's no need to suspect idolatry, even of a shliach who declares the Rebbe to be the Mashiach. Unfortunately, I'm not able to say that with certainty. So therefore, painfully, I have to say that if someone encounters a shliach who says that the Rebbe is the Mashiach up front, with Yechi, with the pictures, with things that are going on in 770 and in Tzfat and in other places where this is more prevalent statistically, then since I don't know what the Miyutu believes that the Rebbe has godly powers, divine powers, is Mutsi or not, so because of my ignorance, and I just don't know how, if I'm able to figure this one out, one has to go to Chumrah, and in that case, there is this suspicion, although I would like to believe it's a Miyutu and a Mutsi, and remove the cloud of suspicion. I don't have a way to ascertain that. There are probably many people on this call. If someone has a way to do so, please feel free to get in touch with Rabbi Hammer or with me. We'll try to ascertain that. But in the absence of that fact being ascertained, so we have the problem of a miyut. It certainly is a miyut. We're not sure if it's matsui or not matsui. So we have to just be more strict and out of doubt. I want to end the way I began, which is that we have to say what we do know for a fact, that the tremendous self-sacrifice on behalf of many of these shluchim, especially those who are in the faraway places that I believe may be the underpinnings of the original question, we have to salute it. We have to thank them for bringing many people closer to the Judaism, for doing chesed with innumerable members of the Jewish community, and we have to, you know, get up and say this is praiseworthy, without being indifferent to the problems that we spoke about. But this is certainly a praiseworthy phenomenon. We have to hope that there'll be, from our perspective, improvement insofar as the elimination of the strand of idolatry within the movement, and again, from our perspective, the elimination or certainly reduction in the number of the shluchim who believe the Rebbe is coming back as the Mashiach, which is a principle that, from the mainstream read of the Rambam and other sources, is not to be accepted. Even though, as I said earlier, that would not necessarily disqualify a person who maintains that belief. This is a very painful question to answer, but since it was asked, I felt I should do what I could, and I apologize if I hurt anyone's feelings. It certainly wasn't meant in that way. Question number four. I'm a rabbi of a small Orthodox shul that was formed as a breakaway from a conservative temple 40 years ago. And my wife and I progressed successfully in our outreach efforts in 12 years. Talmud Torah, daycare, day camp, shiurim, working together with the temple on social activities and holiday programs. There's been talk about merging our congregations. And the temple's president suggested a three-year mechitza proposal. It gives details. It'll be half with a mechitza, half without a mechitza. This is my answer. It's impossible to merge an Orthodox congregation with a conservative temple. It's impossible. Shotness, it's Kalayim. Such a merger cannot exist. The difference between Orthodox and conservative is too great and cannot be bridged, that gap, and you have to have an only Orthodox congregation. The only possibility is if this conservative temple that is talking about merger, generally speaking, when this happens, this is true in many parts of the country, the conservative congregation is in decline. The membership is decreasing, sometimes precipitously. They don't want the institution to close. So then the way the feelers are made to Orthodox Jews in the area to, you know, join forces in some way. And there have been many situations in which previously conservative temples, the word used in the question, have become Orthodox synagogues. Sometimes it happens suddenly. Often it happens in small steps. There's relationships between the Orthodox and the dwindling conservative population, but not mergers. Mergers, I believe, is simply not a way to go. Working together on social activities and holiday programs itself is a problem, which we spoke about two sessions ago. I'm not going to address it again. But there have been cases in which a large building, which is now nearly empty, and there's an additional facility aside from the main sanctuary, a base medrash in a basement or something like, of this nature, which is rented out by an Orthodox group in the community. And as the conservative population in the upstairs sanctuary dwindles and nears disappearance, sometimes it's worked out that the Orthodox congregation will become in charge of the facility, will become an Orthodox congregation, and proper respect will be given to whatever few conservative members remain, but it can only be done if it's a strictly Orthodox congregation with a strictly appropriate mechitza. And even individuals who their whole lives were davening in a conservative congregation without a mechitza, but if the only way for them is to have their building continue to be a Jewish synagogal institution, is that it become Orthodox, so they'll do it. This is known to happen in a number of communities, some in New Jersey and some in Queens and five towns. These kind of arrangements, I believe, are permissible with certain caveats and restrictions. But to actually merge Orthodox and conservative as both running institutions at the same time, I do not believe such a merger is possible, nor do I believe it is possible to compromise on the mechitza issue, which is, I believe it's being suggested in this by the temple president's three-way proposal. I don't think that it qualifies as an Orthodox synagogue, which separates the men and the women completely with an appropriate mechitza. Question number 5. Can one announce the OU job fair on Shabbos? On the one hand, it's obviously a mitzvah to help someone secure a panos. On the other hand, it involves malacha, both in attending and the outcome of securing a job. Yes, we try not to talk about money on Shabbos, but we know that we are allowed to make appeals for tzedakah to poor people and other institutions on Shabbos, even though it relates to money. There's no violation of mimtzo cheftzecha or v'daber dover. It's what we call in our language chefte shamayim and dibush or mitzvah. And therefore, we often have appeals on Shabbos. For tzedakah, Rambam tells us that the highest form of tzedakah, instead of giving someone a handout, is to arrange for him to have a job. And therefore, an OU job fair is the highest level of tzedakah. And for this purpose, if it's necessary to announce it on Shabbos, it should be announced on Shabbos. There's no violation of a daber dover because it's for a mitzvah. And in any event, even though, as the question states, quote, it involves malacha both in attending and the outcome of securing a job, end quote, those malachos are not verbalized on Shabbos. If a daber dover is violated, only if the malacha is stated explicitly, but only hinted at, there was no violation of a daber dover. Okay. We now have more questions. Not sure what order to take them. I see there's a final question, but there's also follow-up questions. I guess we should take the final question and come back to the follow-up questions. The final question is, a mutter to use hand warmers, chemically produced heat on Shabbos. It would apply to someone who's very sensitive to the cold, very cold fingers, or even rain-out syndrome, which cold causes vascular spasm and painful fingers or toes. And it could even lead to loss of limbs, cholila. Staying at home a whole winter could get depressing. They apply to a chola shebo sakana as well. Well, unfortunately, New York City, where I'm calling you from, has had a very cold snap, extraordinarily cold in the last month and a half or so. I don't remember such a cold snap. And there are many, many days when it's difficult to walk out. And certainly we don't want to cause danger to anybody, chas v'shalom. As far as the specifics of these hand warmers, there were two kinds of hand warmers. There was a disposable hand warmers, which you just open something, and then when you open that little pack, so the chemical reaction transpires, and you can put it in your hands, your gloves, you can warm your hands, you can put it in your shoes, it warms your feet, and then you throw it out, it's disposable. That's one kind. There's an additional kind, which is permanent. It's enclosed in some kind of a vacuum pack. You bang it down, and through some chemical reaction is released, it becomes very hot. It could reach 140 degrees, and then it starts cooling down gradually. That's the second question. The first question is addressed in an article by Rabbi Schimmel in Yeshurun, volume 21, page Tafresh Lamed Beis and forward. That's the disposable one. The non-disposables, I haven't seen anything in print, although someone gave me a beautiful article which is not in print yet. To make a long story short, there are significant halachic shailas in both of these types of hand warmers. The question is mevashel. It's one question. Is it an isa d'oraisa, d'rabbanan, or not at all? Molid is sort of a catch-all. When you create something new, this certainly might qualify. Might. Molid is d'rabbanan. Maka b'patish, if you take something which is not working and you make it work. Some suggest it might be maka b'patish. There's many disputes. The bottom line, it seems to me, is that we can be lenient that there is no Easter d'oraisa. However, we cannot be lenient to assume that there's no Easter d'rabbanan. I'm referring to both the disposable and the non-disposable. There could be at least Easter d'rabbanan. There could be Easter d'rabbanan involved in each of them, whether it be molded or some kind of a mevashel betol d'schama, things of this nature, and therefore they should be avoided under normal circumstances. The question, of course, becomes, what about what's called here a chola she'ein bo sakana? So, if an outside chance, chas v'chalila, of a loss of a limb, as we call that sakonas eiver, look on Simon Shin Chav Ches Sif Yudayin, you will see if a sakonas eiver, a rabbinical prohibition is waived, it's set aside. So one question is that hutra d'chuya, in other words, may a person go to shul, even though he's in violation of a rabbinical prohibition, or just stay home? Staying home can not only just be depressing, as it says, but depression can also have an impact on one's health, as is well known. So therefore, it seems to me, if someone is on a level where his limb might be in danger if he goes to shul without these hand warmers, that there's room to be lenient. Again, I'm not sure how common that extreme situation is. What happens if it's not that level, but a person's sensitive to colds and spasms, painful fingers or toes? So that's really bad. It's arguable that such an individual is considered a chola she'ein bo sakana. We'll come to a little later to that, to the definition thereof. And if he's a chola she'ein bo sakana, then there are a number of leniencies. One, ask a non-Jew. So you can ask a non-Jew to open these hand warmers. Or two, if it's done what we call b'shinoi, if it's done in an abnormal way, you can figure out how to do it abnormally. Maybe instead of using hands, you can just drop it to the floor. Or some other way to open it in an abnormal fashion. The advantage of doing it through a non-Jew or doing it in an abnormal fashion is that even in the, if our analysis before is incorrect, and even if there might be an Issa min HaTorah involved in these hand warmers, we can still be lenient for a chola she'ein bo sakana, either by telling a non-Jew, or according to the straight read of the Ramban, to do even a would-be d'oraisa malacha if it's done b'shinui. Now the Shulchan Aruch doesn't sound that way there in Sifya Zayin, and the Mishnah Berurah says not that way. Both the Egle Tal and before the first Lubavitcher Rebbe and Shulchan Aruch Harav, again, both based upon the simple read of the Ramban, that's the source of this halacha, say, the Ramban seems to say, that even a would-be malacha min HaTorah would be permissible b'shinui for the purpose of Chol HaShein Bo Sakana. So therefore, again, if limbs might be in danger, then I believe there's room to be lenient, even if it's necessary to do it yourself in a normal fashion, because we're working with an assumption that there is no Issa D'Oraisa. There are some who say Sakana Seva because not D'Oraisa. We're not going to go into that right now. But in any event, it's preferred to do it through a goy or b'shino, even in that kind of a case. And if there's no Sakana Seva, you would have to do it either through a goy or b'shinoi, as is found in Shulchan Aruch, Siman Shin Chav Ches, Sif Yud Zayin. We now come to what's called the follow-up questions from last time. The first question is, I'll read it after a summation of what I said last time. If she did not end up getting her regular period for a few days, and the staining is subsided, could she then just do a bedika and remain tahora? Normally, the halacha is that if you missed your bedika, then you must do one before resuming tashmish, and then it'll be permitted. But in this case, she willingly and knowingly did not do the bedika because of the staining. So the question is, would that create what we call in our language an iser b'di'evet? Here, I believe, is the answer. On the one hand, the reason in this case that she did not do her bedika at the time of the owner is because she assumed at that time that the bleeding, the staining will continue until her regular period begins shortly thereafter. Therefore, as we said last time, since the entire obligation of Bedika is only to allow a future Tashmish, and at the time of the required Bedika, which is the day of the, we'll call the owner Beninus, at that point in time, she had every reason to assume that she's going to stain straight through until the period comes. So she did not do anything wrong by not doing a bedika at that time, because she had every right to assume, as happens usually, that the staining would continue straight until her period would begin. So she may not be with her husband while she's staining, so therefore there was no purpose to do that bedika, as we mentioned last time. She was confounded. And suddenly it just stopped, and there's no period, and now she wants to know, is she permitted to do a bedika right now and to be permissible to her husband? And the answer to the question is yes, because she was not in violation of anything by failing to do a bedika at the time of her own abandonment. Truth is, generally speaking, even if she had been negligent and did not do a bedika when she should have done a bedika, we do not find that this is going to create a post facto prohibition, so that even if she does a bedika subsequently, she may not resume relations with her husband. I haven't seen that, and it wouldn't apply in this case in any event, as I said before. So therefore, for those two reasons, I believe that the answer is, in this kind of a case, if she does a bedika and it's clean, she may resume relations with her husband. Now, last session, we mentioned chola she'ein bo sakana, someone who cannot function, and presumably does not necessarily a nofel lemishkov in the literal sense. That's true. What's the source of this definition? Well, it's the Ramo himself in that very same sif, Siman Shin Chav Ches Sif Yud Zayin. The Ramo writes, chola imenu kol gufo. The Kenafa Lemishkov Dami. Kenafa Lemishkov is the example that's always quoted. Someone who is considered to be a Chol HaShein Bo Sakana. He has to go to sleep, has to go to bed, he can't get out of bed. That is true. But someone who is Chol HaKol HaGuf, his whole body is sick, is the equivalent, as the Rambam writes, of someone who is Nafa Lemishkov. Now, what's that equivalency? He's He's not in his bed. He's just walking around. So the presumed equivalency is if someone is nafal the mishkav, he's prisoner to his bed, then he's unable to carry on his functions in a normal way. People have to get around. He can't. He can't leave his bed. So therefore, he's not functioning in a normal way. That's why it's considered to be a chola. And that's the basis for the extension that someone who gets out of bed and is walking around and maybe even leaving the house, but he's unable to function in a normal fashion, that he would be categorized as a chole she'enbo sakona. Now, in the specific case of Ritalin, which was discussed last time, obviously there are different circumstances, there are different cases. Some can function without their pills, others cannot. As he said last time, we thought that even if the missing of one pill might in and of itself not lead to a psychiatric meltdown whereby he's unable to function normally, it would still be permissible to take the Ritalin or the pill on the grounds that if you left it long term, it would lead to that meltdown, and you're not required to wait till the last pill. Once you know that long term, if you stop the medicine, you would become a cholesha ein bo sakana, then even if missing one pill would not lead to that situation, it's permissible to take that pill on Shabbos. A last question. Is prostate fluid considered shechvah zera in regard to the latter's various halachos, e.g., regarded as so on the context of Zichos Tefillah, Tevilas Ezra, Hotzoa Zera, etc.? A very technical question, although there can be cases where it's relevant. And the source I'd give you is the Otzer HaPoskim on Evan Ezra, Simen Chof Gimel, Sif Koton Aleph, Os Gimel, has a dispute upon whether the Easter of Hotzoa Zera Levatol applies. It's called Zera She'eno Roy Laholid. There is a man has the something which comes out of his body, but it's unable, that zera would be unable to impregnate a woman. Is there a violation or is there no violation? So the greatest gedolim argue. Some say yes and some say no. Those who say no, but they take the word zera literally. Zera means to plant, to seed, to have the ability to produce a child. And if it can't produce a child, then it would not be an Easter of Otzoas, or Hashchosa Zera, or Otzoa Zera. It's simply not Zera. Whatever it is, it's prostatic fluid, but it's not Zera. That is the lenient approach. And again, that's presumably based on the assumption that the Easter is along the lines of some of the various psukim that are quoted, you know, and go back to the original source of Eir Va'onan and Pashas Vayeshev, Kilo Lo Yazara, the context is producing children, and if that's the nature of the Yisra, based on that Pasuk or other psukim which are produced to demonstrate the nature of this prohibition, which is presumably a Torah prohibition, a Daraisa, then it would have to be limited to a situation in which the potential for having a child is undone by the zera being, if you will, coming out of the body, not in the context of relations with the wife. So that would be a violation only in a case in which potentially a child could have been produced with that same zera. On the other hand, there are a number of other sources given in the Gemara for the Rishonim, the Poskim, for the violation of Otzoa Zera Levatola. And some of them seem to talk in a more general sense. Some even say, we just read last week, Lo Sinof, and they extended to that kind of an activity because it's an inappropriate utilization of an organ which is supposed to be used only by Kedusha. It's now being used in a non-Kedusha fashion, especially Biyad, but some even extended beyond that. So that would be a potential prohibition, even in the absence of any possibility of having a child. Many years ago, there was a discussion, certainly yeshivas, that there were young men who were concerned that in the context of being with their wives, the kedusha of tahara, that sometimes they felt that something came out before the actual relations commenced. There was a fear that that itself might be some kind of a violation of otzah zera levatala. It's certainly possible that what comes out at the very beginning is coming from the prostate. And there were great rabbanim quoted as saying that that was not a problem. That's a bit of a different question. Again, it's not clear what the question is over here. There, the drop of prostate fluid came out, not in the context of an entire, we'll use the word ejaculation, and therefore there's more reason to be lenient in that kind of a case. Tonight we've been answering the last question, which is Hotzah Zera, and incidentally, in that Otra Poskim there, he quotes further on in Os Yud, the discussion of whether semen analysis is permissible when the individual is moti zera for the purpose of testing. And one of the leniencies which is quoted is the fact that the mere fact that they're testing it indicates that there's a chance that the zera is not able to impregnate a woman. And if that is the case, some rabbis have written in Gedolei Poskim that that's not considered to be a violation in the first place, even if there's a full ejaculation. So this is the sources you'll find in Otra Poskim. You can also look in Tzitz Eliezer Chelek Yudalit, where he talks about this as well, as also in the encyclopedia Hilchatit Rufuit of Rav Dr. Steinberg under Zera. Now, that's Otzah Zera. Tvilas Ezra, one could argue that, again, if we're referring to a case that this prostatic fluid is coming out in the context of relations between husband and wife, one could argue that even if it's not considered to be zera in the full sense, and therefore there would be no violation of otzah zera, that the reason of shloyu mitzuyim etel neshem shosem ketana golem might apply in such a case. As you all know, Tvilas Ezra is not required nowadays, so we're not going to go into it from a purely technical sense. The only time in the context of Hilchos Tvila, which is found in Siman Ayin Vav, in Orach Chaim, if you look in the Mishnah Berurah, there's Sifkot and Tezayin, he quotes from the Magen Avraham and the Gra, that it's not really so, it's just a Chumrah. But Mikir Adin, it's not considered so in the context of Tvila. Tvilas Ezra is not required, Medina. Hotzah Zera, again, presumably we're discussing cases, you know, after the fact, or what a person, what his responsibility should be, and going backwards, going forward, we would normally not do these things. So is there any real case where the shaila is a real halacha lemaisa? What I could think of is for Sfardim, who deny the low plug of Ashkenazim in Yordaeus and Mekuf Tzarivov in the context of Poletes. Poletes, of course, is quoted by Rashi in Parshas Yisro, one Masechta Shabbos, which would preclude the beginning of the Shiva Nekiyim. So the question would be if a couple is married and the man's Zera is not potent, maybe because of he was born with a defect. I mean, there were certain chemotherapies. Sometimes it could be a case where there was a prostate problem which required a vasectomy. All these kinds of cases, if the couple is Sephardic, would there be any need for them to wait the 4 days that a typical couple would have to wait before commencing the Shiva Nekiyim? That is a real halachic question, which is not merely a chumrah or a minik, and that's a a dispute, which I believe those who follow that custom would have to resolve. If we follow Minhag Ashkenaz, it's not really relevant to us. So therefore, none of these questions here are relevant in a pure halachic sense, although they're all very important in a broader sense. My time is up. I want to thank you for listening again, and thank you for the follow-up questions. And if there's an interest, Bli Neder, in 2 weeks from now, we can have another session, Rabbi Hammer.
Thank you, Rabbi Willig. We appreciate Rabbi making time for this. Chevra, after a while, if you want to email me about getting a copy of the recording, first we will listen to it all, and then we'll get back to everybody. Thanks again for being on the call. Speak to you soon. Take care.
Bye-bye.